the 47th podcast of Old School Guns. Now, you'll notice that it'll say we have 48 when you look at the deal, because I did an introduction primer just kind of talking about, at the very beginning, what my objectives were and kind of explaining where the podcast would go and what it would look like. So those are, that one is out there, so there's actually one more, but this is like the 47th official episode. So let's get right into it. And I have to say that one of the coolest things I did was go see the movie Midway, Veterans Day weekend. And Midway is an absolutely great motion picture. I mean, you know, it gets criticized because they, first of all, they have to use CGI. Okay, well, I'm sorry, that's just the way it goes. I would love it if they could film something like that without CGI, but I just don't think that's practical, and certainly you couldn't even afford it today. $500 million, you know, the planes, all the ships, and trying to make all that kind of stuff work, and using modeling, even very advanced modeling. There's always an aspect problem between even a 20-foot ship model and the water around it. There's always a fakey look to it. And the other thing, too, is, you know, in some of these giant movies that were filmed way back before CGI, you know, there was a lot of risk to stuntmen and pilots and everything else. So, you know, CGI is fine. CGI is fine. How it will stand up over the years, I don't know. I mean, 50 years from now, people may look at it and it may just look incredibly bad to compared to what they're used to then. But, you know, for right now, CGI is the way to go. I felt they really tried to do a very good job in telling the story, and they hit the highlights. They definitely hit the highlights. The great part is they showed the context very, very well, not just the battle in isolation, but, you know, they started with Pearl Harbor, they cover that, they go through the Doolittle Raid, and, you know, mention a bit about the Battle of the Coral Sea, and so it really does fit in, and you kind of get the idea of what the first 6 months of the war kind of looked like. And I really felt that they did a very, very good job with all that. Now, that being said, of course, the critics are panning the movie, talking about the, you know, kind of hokey dialogue. But that's kind of the way people spoke back then. If you ever spend any time around Greatest Generation, you know, World War II veterans, well, that's how they spoke. I mean, they were kind of stoic. They said things that were, you know, concise, kind of to the point, brevity. It wasn't all the emo stuff you see now in movies. You know, they really did an excellent job. And I don't know who their technical advisors were, but they did very, very well. And one of the things I liked the most were there were a lot of younger actors. Joe Jonas was one. Darren Criss was another. And these are kind of millennial guys. They're millennials. And, you know, they pulled it off. They acted, and they were very authentic, very believable as what the guys in the 1940s were like, guys who grew up during the Depression. And then, you know, they grow up through the Depression, through their teenage years, and all of a sudden, they're in a world war. So, you know, they didn't have the fun, frolicking childhood and young adulthood that a lot of subsequent generations or members of them have enjoyed. You know, they grew up in hard circumstances, and then it was a world war. And when it was over with, these guys were, you know, in their late 20s, early 30s, and whatever it was. And then they had to get on with life. Then there was, you know, it was kind of like start over and go. So, you know, it really kind of covered who those guys were and what they did very, very well. Now, it won't win any awards. And sadly, it won't win any awards for a couple different reasons. The first reason is it basically cheers America and the American spirit, and that's just never going to get an award in Hollywood, and that's never going to get anything but poo-pooed by the, you know, kind of the left fringe of the country. I bet Nancy Pelosi doesn't even see it. Adam Schiff, they'll hate it. To them, it's just a bunch of, you know, to them, it's just all the values they don't like. The next reason is really the worst reason. And that is because they told the story, they cast the characters the way they were supposed to be. Therefore, you don't see a lot of diversity. So, you know, it's not going to have the things that make modern movies popular with the critics and the awards people. That is, there's no lesbian love triangle. There's no openly gay character. There's no key scene in the movies where minority groups save everyone. And, you know, it's just not any of that. It's not any of that, so a lot of people won't like it. But it was the Battle of Midway. And it's not going to have all these modern little messaging and plot twists that people want in there. All these little requirements to make a movie acceptable, politically correct and acceptable. It's not going to have those. So therefore, it won't win anything. But I do hope it makes a lot of money. I will buy the DVD. I will buy the DVD. And, you know, when you look at that, there's another movie that never really got much coverage or much anything, but showed the same kind of grit, was The Memphis Belle with Matthew Modine. I mean, that was really a first-rate movie, and it showed that same kind of grit, and basically in the same kind of context, that aviation of, I'm going to fly into fire and do my mission. That's what I'm going to do. And it's guys who basically kind of had a choice. They could have kind of flown off to the side, or they could have avoided it one way or another, but they chose not to. They went in basically to the jaws of the dragon. And you know, you have to really admire that. You have to really admire that. One of the best scenes in Midway was really about the Doolittle raid, when they, you know, when Doolittle's plane is launched off the ship in the rainstorm, and, you know, they can't see a thing. They don't even know what direction they're going in. They kind of know the azimuth, maybe, but they don't know if they're headed straight down to the ocean or what the deal is, because there's absolutely nothing. They can't see outside the cockpit. They can't see anything. So that was really an amazing scene, and the movie was very, very good, and it's the kind of movie you can take younger people to see. It's not gory, it's not, you know, really horrible, but it shows truth, and it shows, you know, kind of what the Japanese did. You know, the Japanese were not nice during World War II. They weren't these fun little people who, you know, danced around with samurai swords and were kind of, you know, what we have kind of thought the post-war Japanese are. These were hardcore militarist, imperialist, very, very bad people. And, you know, they were just as bad as the Nazis. The Imperial Japanese were just as bad as the Nazis. And that's just the way it goes. And that's kind of what it shows. And I really, really enjoyed it and recommend it to everyone. And, you know, I will buy the DVD because it's a keeper. Okay, the next thing is, I don't know if anybody's keeping up with this impeachment fiasco. I mean, to me, it's gotten so convoluted with, well, we have secret hearings, and we're going to have public hearings, and who's the whistleblower, and everybody's saying conflicting things. I think the important thing to know on that is, you know, you see who the people who are really trying to hurt democracy are. You know, you can't really follow this thing and not know that it's Pelosi, it's Schiff, and it's all the Democrats that voted for it. The stooges, the stooge political party, and they just ordered everybody to vote for it, and all but two did, and the two who didn't, they probably gave them permission to vote against it because they were in heavy Trump districts. So, you know, that's politics. You know, they'll let those guys do that when they know they have enough votes to get the thing in the bag. So I feel that it was a sham, a fraud, and that's what it is. So, you know, and it's clear that this thing is going to be dead in the Senate. Even I don't see any enthusiasm for it. I even think the Senate Democrats aren't as stupid as they look, and I think they're gonna basically flee from this thing. And they may even call them up and say, "Don't actually do this," because they're gonna look horrible. They're absolutely gonna look horrible. And the only reason this is happening, face it, you know, they tried to get Trump with a Mueller report that turned out to be complete garbage. And they've brought this garbage up because their candidates are slugs. None of their candidates are going to do any, you know, they've got Joe Biden on tape where he threatened the Ukrainian government with aid if they didn't fire the prosecutor. You know, everybody knows that essentially the Democrats have nobody, you know, they have nobody. That's why even old Bloomberg is thinking about getting in. It's too late. He's blown it now because just getting the apparatus up and rolling to get onto the ballots and generate some enthusiasm. And Bloomberg is just another geezer. He's like Sanders, Biden. Those geezers, you know, they're going to wind up giving the domination to Biden because he has some name recognition. He can hearken back to the Obama days, but they're scared. It could be a social, or they'll give it to a socialist like Elizabeth Warren. I think she scares the party. They don't want to do that, but it'll be like George McGovern in 1972. They put up this socialist, they get shellacked, and then they can tell those people, the Squad among others, and some of these other budding socialists, hey, get out of here, we're not going to tolerate you. As they did to the socialists after George McGovern. That's just the way that worked. So, you know, it's interesting to see how this will come out, but this is definitely, what an embarrassment. It's a fiasco, an embarrassment. Even internationally, other countries looking at this must think, this really stupid. And all they're trying to do is undermine Trump, which nobody tried to undermine Obama like that. People opposed him and opposed a lot of his policies, but they didn't try anything as stupid as this. And I hope it blows up in their face. Now to get to something that is really, really ugly. And that's those cartel murders that occurred in Mexico. Some Mormon settlements that went down there in the 1950s. And they've been kind of living and farming down there, I assume. Obviously for over 60 years, maybe close to 70 years. And, you know, they were living down there. But then, you know, Mexico changed from the 1950s. Mexico is probably, you know, somewhat corrupt, but now it's run by narco-terrorists. Narco-terrorists control a lot of that country. And, you know, we've given military aid and anti-drug aid to Mexico, but it's a mess. Mexico is a mess. And that's why people want to get out of there as much as they can. And that's why kind of why we need a border, because they've infiltrated some of these cartel people. They're here. They're illegals. They're here. And they have got to go. This is bad business, shooting infants and the other stuff they were doing. These people are ruthless and hideous. And that's why people want a wall. That's why a lot of Americans want a wall to keep this kind of nonsense out. And you know, someday Mexico will actually have to get responsible and get a decent government. And until the people of Mexico force that to happen by just having a real widespread revolution, I'd rather see Pancho Villa down there rallying the peons and the little farmers and all that, and maybe turning them into a peasant army and taking over the country. I'd rather see that than cartels run the thing. And, you know, it's only a matter of time before these kind of gang, cartel, all this kind of stuff, we let this get across the border, it's going to be a mess to clean up, and it's going to be very ugly to clean up. And I think it just absolutely at this point has to be prevented from getting here. And that's just the way it is. Everybody kind of giggles about, you know, go down to Home Depot and there's illegals looking for day work. Well, I think that, you know, that's a whole different situation. You know, we don't know that all those guys are just looking for day work. We don't know how they got here. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know who they're connected to. Or are they susceptible for being recruited once they're here? Nobody knows anything about that. So that's why it has to be prevented. And that's why people have to start taking immigration seriously. These murders, you know, this is almost Manson-style stuff. it had to be clear to them that these people were not really a threat. Even if they mistook the SUVs for something else, this appears that they must have known, sent a signal, whatever all this was, they knew who they were attacking and what they were doing. Hey, the last thing to talk about is really just, has nothing really to do with guns, but has something to do with just the oddness of culture. And that is, I don't know if anybody's been following this college admissions scandal. Basically, it turns out to be rich people hiring a third party to get their kids into, quote, the right universities, quote, unquote. And basically faking, using any fake, like cheating on the SATs and making them fake athletes so they could go into some non-existent team. And it appears that it's mostly girls because, you know, there isn't a real lot of spotlight. Even though Title IX basically says for every boy's sport you have to have a girl's equivalent, a lot of the female-only sports don't really get the scrutiny or the attention. They just sort of exist because regulatorily they have to. So I guess for girls, it's a lot easier to kind of fake up, you know, some sort of athletic resume, get on there as being, you know, accepted to be part of the crew team or whatever these other sports are. And then they just sort of drift away. You know, they probably don't participate, or they somehow don't make the team or whatever. But they're in the university, and that's all good. This has probably been going on for a long time. And so they're getting around to trying and punishing some of these people, especially the celebrities, you know. And it turns out that these two, one was, what was her name, Felicity Huffman, who I've never seen act because I don't watch any of the Housewives shows. The other one is this Lori Loughlin. You know, but the bottom line is they're nonviolent first offenders. And, okay, you know, the law is, it is what it is. There are a lot of people who donate money to colleges and their kids get a segue in there. That's just the way colleges work. They work on money. Colleges and universities are designed to make money. They're not designed to educate children or educate young people. They're not designed to do that. They used to be. But, you know, the cold hard reality in the real world is if you're not financially squared away and self-supporting or figure out an income stream, you don't exist anymore. You know, you just don't exist anymore, which is why even, you know, the biggest charities in the country do active recruiting for money, and, you know, they actively go out and hold events and basically curry donors and all that to keep the money going, to keep their charities going. College is the same way. If they want to be in the education business, well, they got to treat it like a business. So, you know, and there's some nefarious people on the fringes of this and willing to take money to get the kids in the school and all the rest of it. Should it be allowed? No, it should be policed and checked out pretty thoroughly. And, you know, that needs to be cleaned up. I don't know that it's something that they need to overreact and send somebody to jail for 45 years on. I would also say that, and this is going to be fairly unpopular, but we're talking about fake athletes who are getting into institutions of higher education. We've never talked about the fake students who are athletes who get in there. And, you know, all you got to do is look around, and probably not very hard, but if you look around enough, you'll see that there are a lot of professional athletes and people who maybe didn't make it into the professional ranks, but they were recruited, they were brought in, they had special help with their tests and all that. And they were strictly brought into the school to be on an athletic team. They weren't brought there because they're a genius. They weren't brought there because, well, when he's not a running back on the football team, he'll be the anchor. He'll be a big asset to our physics department. No, that doesn't happen. And you know that, you know, just human nature, you know that there's a lot of record faking and all the rest of this going on. And I can tell you, when you even back in the day when I was in college, there were guys who, they would read the roll the first day of class, and there'd be two or three of the guys who you knew were on one of the sports teams, and, you know, the kind of the higher profile guys, you see, oh, he's in this class, but you never saw him. And my guess always was that maybe they dropped a class, okay, maybe, but at least in some cases, that guy was on the rolls, got a grade for the class, and never showed up, or took some sort of special test, or whatever else, because, you know, frankly, the guy was there to play football, basketball, baseball, or something else, and could not cut it, just could not cut the class, so he was helped through. That's the way it goes. That's the way it goes. So if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. I think if you're going to recognize one half of the problem, which are privileged, wealthy people kind of buying their way in, I think we need to look at the other side of the coin, which is maybe some of these people coming in purely for athletics, so the school looks good on bowl day or during the tournament or whatever else. Maybe all this and that kind of needs to be looked at too, because I'm sure that there's some behavior and practices going on there that everybody would find equally objectionable. Now we can go to my favorite part of the podcast, which is questions and answers. And I always like these, and I gather these things up from all over the place. Usually a lot of them come out of conversations I have where people know that I know a little something about firearms, and so, you know, that's kind of it. So anyway, I just want to go to the first one here, which is apropos for this cold snap, which has gripped most of the country, and that is, what do you think are the best cold weather rifles and handguns? And I'm gonna narrow this down to kind of put it into military rifles, tactical rifles, because that's what I like the best, and that's what I know the best. Sporting rifles, they're really all about the same, and I think they perform fine. Guys take them into the field and hunt in cold weather. They go from Alaska to all kinds of places, Siberia, all kinds of places, and hunt things in the wintertime or in cold weather. And with northern United States, Canada, you know, there's a lot of hunting, and they all seem to be fine. So sporting rifles all basically seem to be just fine, and I don't know that there's any real preference. If I did have a preference, I would say probably a bolt gun over an autoloader, just simply because, you know, manually operating it, you can bring a lot more strength to it. But, you know, I don't even know that that's a real consideration. When it comes to military-style tactical rifles, I would have to say my favorite cold weather rifles are, there's two of them. One is the AK series, doesn't matter, 74, 47, RPK. They handle very well. They have large trigger guards. You can get a gloved finger in there. The controls are pretty positive and large, easy to get a hold of. And just, you know they've been tested in the cold. You know that the people who made them and the people who used them operated in the cold. So that's a very, very good rifle to have in a cold environment. My other favorite cold weather rifle is the HK-91 type rifle. I mean, to me, that's really well designed for the cold. And not only is it just, they have the ergonomics. Again, it's got a big safety you can hit with a glove. It's got a big trigger guard, uncomplicated control. Even the charging handle, you know, you can manage that with gloves. It's very, very well designed for cold weather. And of course, the Germans were, when they designed it, you know, even when they were doing it with Spain and all that, they were kind of looking at, you know, they remembered what the Eastern Front was like. And I think they designed a weapon that could perform in those kind of conditions. The other thing I like about it is the fluted chamber. I always felt that was a really more of, I know it fits in well with the roller lock system and all of that. And, you know, because the roller lock system doesn't have the extraction But I always thought that that was also a cold weather enhancement too, that there would be less metal to stick inside the chamber, and therefore the fluted chamber was a something that would be very useful in the cold and would cut down on malfunctions and make the gun overall more reliable, which it does in every environment, I think. So those are my two favorite ones. Is there anything wrong with anything else? I would say no. ARs are fine in the cold. You know, even Mini-14s, M1s, M14s, FALs, they're all fine. But when a cold weather rifle kind of comes to mind, I tend to gravitate towards the AKs and the H&K. And in fact, I most of the time do it every year. I'll go out, and it may be 0 degrees, and I'll take an HK out and shoot at gongs at 200 yards just to do it, just to say, man, I know these things work well in sub-zero weather, so I'm going to take it out and test it out in that. And I've done the same thing with AKs, too. So, but I'm not saying that the other ones aren't fine, but that's what really comes to my mind. And in fact, the AR is actually well designed for cold weather. If you have the standard GI kind of trigger guard, you know that you can actually take the bottom of that off to facilitate getting a glove in there. That you take it and it hinges down against the pistol grip. So it's actually pretty cool that way. They were actually thinking ahead. Another example of the Stoner design was just so excellent. And it was ahead of its time, and it took us years to recognize it. So there you go. Those are my two favorite. Those are my favorite firearms for the rifles, anyway, for the cold weather. The other one is handguns. Is a lot harder because all handguns are fundamentally about the same. The trigger guards are about the same size. There are some ones that are a little bit larger than others. You know, you pay your money and take your choice, but none of them are really that good with a heavy glove. That's the thing. The trigger guards on the rifles are a lot larger, so you can actually shoot that with a glove or even the trigger mittens. Sometimes I use the trigger mittens. It's so cold. Or only the trigger finger. You know, everything else is in a mitten, and the edge of it where the trigger finger is has got a finger. So you can kind of slip your finger up into that, use that, and fire the gun, and then slip it back down into the mitten when you're not shooting. So it's kind of nice that way. But, you know, the only handgun I know that was optimized for cold weather was the Finnish Leite, which actually had an accelerator because, yes, it is cold in Finland, and during the Winter War and during the winter, they know it's cold, so they actually had like a little accelerator thing put on there as a way to kind of help push that open. I don't think it was ever needed, and from what I understand, Glocks are very good in cold weather. So, you know, and I don't think any gun really has a distinct advantage in cold weather. Trying to think of one with a distinct advantage, and I just can't really come up with it. So, if anybody knows, let me know. But a distinct advantage in cold weather is really tough to come by. And I don't know that anybody could really design one. When you think that the Nagant revolver, my favorite revolver, was used in cold weather, and it was very complicated, you know, the way the cylinder indexes forward to seal the breech and all that. I mean, if that thing could survive and do fine in cold weather, I think just about any good gun design can do that, whether it's semi-automatic or a revolver. So with handguns, I don't think it really makes much of a difference. The next question is, lever guns. How good are lever guns for hunting and or possibly personal defense? Well, I would say that lever guns are very good for a lot of things, but they're not great at any one thing. And one of the reasons they're not as popular today is because people tend to go for purpose-built, optimized guns, no matter what they're doing. There just isn't much of a call for a general versatile firearm, because most people say if I want to do this one specific task, I will get a firearm tailored to that task. So you don't see as many lever guns as you would. The people who like them are people who probably live in an outdoor environment and do a lot of shooting kind of informally on their property or on their ranches or something, where they need a gun that's relatively lightweight, lever action, has reasonably good capacity, and if they've got the full tube magazines, no matter what the caliber, they've got reasonably good capacity. You can get them in a variety of calibers, and you know, they're very handy. They're slim guns. They're not that heavy. They're very, very handy. So therefore, they're really pretty good. Now, do they have the best long range performance? Well, generally not compared to something else. Are they the best defense gun? Well, compared to the tactical guns, they clearly are not. But they can do a lot of different things well. And one of the best things about them is they don't have the appearance that the modern tactical guns do. So they kind of have a little bit more benign appearance. We're all used to seeing, you know, lever guns. We know, hey, cowboys and ranchers and everybody carried them. It's looked upon with more of a utilitarian type look and kind of a practical and a little bit nostalgic look, as opposed to an AR-15 that's, you know, tricked out. You know, it's going to have a little different appeal, and it's going to have a little different impression. So the lever gun is good with everything. It was also the original pistol caliber carbine. You know, they came in a variety of calibers. Even back in the 1880s, you could get 22 long rifle Winchester 73s, which, you know, it's pretty unique thinking about that. But they had them. They also had them in, of course, the, you know, 38-40, 44-40, not 45 Colt. That's kind of a modern thing. But they were available, a 32-20, I think 25-20. You know, all those cartridges could be chambered in handguns as well. And so you had one ammunition type that you could service both a handgun and a rifle with, and keep them both supplied. In areas where you don't get a lot of selection, or, you know, there isn't, you know, you could shift from one to another, and so it kind of made things a lot easier. Now, usually, the rifle is always usually a little underpowered, but hey, that's the way it goes. And then they didn't really see that as a problem back then, because they weren't used to the more powerful guns. I think the 30-30 Winchester was a real revolution when it came out. The 94, when it came out, and it, you know, they got it into 30-30, and then later to 32 Winchester Special, was considered a reasonably powerful gun. Nowadays we kind of look at it and say, well, you know, not so much. But, you know, it's still got some whump to it, especially out to about 200 yards. After that, the bullet really starts losing velocity and trajectory and all that. But, you know, they were purchased. Let's see, I know the U.S. military purchased some to use up in the Pacific Northwest during the First World War. And I do believe both the Canadians and the British purchased quantities of them. And there were probably quantities of them donated to the British, you know, when they were afraid the British Isles would be invaded and we sent a bunch of civilian guns over there. So, you know, the military use, the 30-30, has always kind of been, it was used in the Mexican Revolution. You know, it was a gun that had some self-defense chops to it. Again, it's got simple sights, simple to load, reasonable capacity, six or so cartridges. You know, and the cartridge performs well. It's a powerful cartridge. So, it was a good gun for that. I really think that, you know, the lever gun was never going to be a predominant military rifle, simply because you can't fire it when prone. Or it's difficult to fire when prone. You have to turn the gun sideways, and it gives you no advantage over a bolt gun then. But, you know, had we gotten super desperate, we might have used a Winchester Model 1895 in 30-06. Might have been something that would supplemented our Springfields, had we not had the 1917 rifle, that might have been something we would have had to turn to. So it's a very interesting to kind of check the defensive slash military use of lever action rifles. Not a lot, but there's enough of it out there that it's intriguing, a very intriguing history. Okay, next question, and this is a really good one. Are double action slash single action style pistols dead? And what that means is the traditional, like the Beretta 92, a double action the first shot, and then a single action pull after that, which is generally a lot lighter, about half the trigger weight. And you get there by chambering around, and then you have a hammer drop device that you actuate, which eases the hammer down on the loaded chamber, and then you can fire a double action like you would a double action revolver. However, the subsequent shots are a lot lighter, and it's single action with the gun already being cocked. So that's always been controversial. As going back to the 1960s, listening to Jeff Cooper called it an ingenious solution for a non-existent problem. Because he believed, and a lot of people believe, that, hey, the Colt 1911 has already got like three safeties. You've got a hammer notch, which nobody really thought was a great safety. But you had the thumb safety, and you had a grip safety. So, you know, hey, carry that thing around cocked. Well, there's just a visceral response to that when people see a cocked gun sitting in a holster like that, even if you have the leather strap in between the hammer and the slide. Most people look at that and don't believe it's safe. So, and, you know, we also had millions of veterans from World War II, Korea, and a few things after that, you know, they were trained not to do that. So, therefore, the cocked and locked single action auto was not looked upon as what was going to be the solution. The auto pistol solution was the double action design, which was pioneered by Walther and others, but really used wide scale on the Walther P-38, and every pistol afterwards that had that thing is essentially copied it. The CZ-75, a little different, doesn't have a hammer drop. You actually have to kind of pull the trigger and control the hammer, which is a little dicier, but anyway, be that as it may, that was predominant from the 60s through the probably 90s, early 2000s, when the striker frame pistols, starting with the Glock in the late 80s, just started gaining momentum and taking over more of the market. But the real question is, are they dead? Is it just another obsolete type? And I look at it and say, well, it's just kind of fitting into this. It's kind of fitting into this buffet of what do you really want? There's not a lot of companies making them anymore. There are a few still making them. Berettas are obviously still out there and going strong because the guns have a lot of good attributes. FN and HK still make, you know, that type, and they're even made on some polymer frames now. CZ makes them on polymer frames. So it's a really good gun and a really good design. And I think it'll be around. I think it'll still be around. There are people who like a hammer and don't like hammerless design. There are people who like safeties that are not on the trigger. You know, I don't care for them. I don't want one. So therefore, I will probably be stuck with the DASA. And, you know, 20 years from now, I don't know. Maybe these striker-fired pistols will... There could be a rise and fall of the striker-fired pistol. You never know. I mean, things are popular, then they become unpopular. We saw the 9mm become extremely popular at the expense of the 38 Special. And 38 Special died as a law enforcement caliber, except maybe in a few backup guns or something. Then we saw the 40 Smith & Wesson become wildly popular at the expense of the 9mm, to the point where when the Army was thinking about adopting a new handgun, you know, for a while the talk was going to be 40 Smith & Wesson. But then the wave changed again, and they realized 40 Smith & Wesson is not the panacea. Although I still think it's a darn good cartridge. Then they went back to 9mm, and we talked about that last podcast. you know, the reasons for that, you know, essentially training and marksmanship and size of the guns, weight of the guns, capacity, you know, those for those issues. Also, improved bullet design, that thing that gets thrown out every time. Oh, it's an improved bullet design. Oh, okay. We've been listening to that since the 1960s. So, it could very well be that the striker-fired pistol becomes unpopular and something else takes its place. We'll have to see, but I don't think they're dead, but I think they're never going to be as popular as they once were. That's just a fact. They're going to be like revolvers, like single stacks, single action, I should say, automatics. They're going to be out there, and there's always going to be some, but they're never going to have the majority of the market share like they once enjoyed. Okay. What advice would you give to firearms manufacturers and ammunition manufacturers? Well, I don't think they would value this too much. But first, let's talk about ammo. What would I tell the people who make ammunition? What I would tell them is, hey, if you want to concentrate on premium ammunition and have premium stuff, that's fine. But I would say that you have to have low-cost ammunition. If you want the shooting sport to survive, you have to have low-cost ammunition. It's just like you know, automobiles as a hobby. If you want people to drive muscle cars, you better have cheap gas. $8 a gallon gas won't cut it. If the only ammunition out there is going to be high cost, then you're going to strangle the shooting sports because you'll price people out of it. So one of the things that kept shooting sports going in the 90s and going in the early 2000s was there was an influx of basically surplus cheap ammo. And there's still a little bit out there, not nearly like there used to be. And these manufacturers, some of them are kind of catching on. You know, of course, we have the cheap Russian stuff, the Tull ammo, and Black Bear, Silver Bear, whatever bear, you know, Polar Bear, whatever all that is. You also have Wolf and all the rest of that. You have that out there, and you know, that people buy it because of the price point. And other manufacturers got to get on the same thing. I appreciate premium ammo. I've used the Fort Scott ammo, and, you know, it's really first rate. I really like it. I think it is excellent stuff. But it hurts when you're putting $40 worth of ammo into three magazines. I mean, it hurts. Now, it's good because if I ever have to use that, it's going to perform well, and it's money well spent. It's money very, very well spent. But I cannot afford to do that with all my practice ammo. At some point, I have to go cheap because I've hit the limit of my shooting budget. So at some point, I have to go cheap, and where I go cheap is with practice ammo where I can't really pick up the brass anyway. So that's where it is. So they've got to keep those lines open, and they've got to keep some cheap ammo out there. Yes, you can have your for 338 Lapua. Do you need cheap ammo? No, you don't, because people who buy that are buying it for the specific high performance style of bullets and other stuff that's out there. But for 9mm, 7.62x39, 5.56. And I would even say 7.62x51, you have to have a quality, low-cost ammo out there. For 7.62x51, the steel case just doesn't make it. So you really need a brass case, ball M80 equivalent, so people can shoot. You want people to shoot. And you've got to keep 22 ammo low, too. You want kids to shoot. You definitely want people out there to shoot. And so, hey, if you're on a budget and you've got a brick of 22 ammo, it's better if that brick costs $10 and $40. I mean, it just is. So that's what has to happen. Ammunition prices are what fuel the shooting sports, because that's the way it is, and that's just the way the economics work. To firearms manufacturers, I would say that, again, price is important, and we see that in the AR market right now. Prices are at historic lows. You can build an AR rifle for, you know, really get an upper and get a lower, and if you're willing to put your own parts in, you can get it very economical. It won't be the top of the line. It won't woo anybody because it doesn't have the, you know, chrome-plated superhero barrel that everybody wants. It won't have, you know, the coolest names on the lower. It won't have all that stuff, but it'll be a usable, great rifle. I mean, it'll be a usable, great rifle. So, you know, and that's at a very low price point. So price is important, and quality is important, and variety is important. And they just have to figure out how to make all that stuff work. You know, it just, if they don't do that, if it becomes a rich man's hobby, it'll go away. It'll just get legislated away because nobody will care and nobody will want to deal with it. So that's the advice I would give firearms and ammo manufacturers, and I'm sure they've heard it before. Okay, what new shooting sport would you like to see? And that was a hard question because I couldn't really think of anything. I thought every shooting sport basically existed. And then I thought of just, there's only one thing that I think that does not exist now, which could exist. That would be a 22 shooting sport, based with 22 long rifles and pistols, that would be tactical in nature, almost a two-gun, that would be done at, you know, maybe 50 yards, maybe 75 yards for longer targets for the rifle, and maybe out to 20 yards for pistols, maybe 25, whatever it is. I haven't really designed anything. But it would be designed for really military trainer type rifles. It'd be a course of fire that you could shoot with your STG 22, that's, you know, your ATI STG 44 and 22 caliber, or any of the 22 ARs with iron sights, any of the military trainers. You know, there were some 22 caliber AKs that pop onto the market every now and again. So there's a few of those out there. There's also, you know, the standard military trainers that, you know, take a, you know, 5-shot magazine, and some of them are Mosin-Nagant, some of them are Mausers, some of them are a few other things. So those would be welcome. The other thing that would be welcome would be just kind of any open-sighted 22 bolt gun, lever gun, semi-auto, you know. And here's where it gets sticky, though. You would almost have to say there's no open class. There would have to be factory production standard weight barrels. And you'd have to do that to keep it from becoming like NRL 22, where the big dollar people have wrecked it for the rest of us. So to keep the big dollar assholes out of there, you basically have to make it kind of for these rimfire military look-alike clones. And that'd be a lot of fun. It'd be a lot of fun to shoot a match with a 22 STG. You know, maybe something where you're doing a little moving and scooting, something like that. Now, it would have to be constructed more on a three-gun or a cowboy action type of deal where you go through individually, because if you just shot shoulder to shoulder on a target with rings, scoring rings, whoever has the most accurate gun wins. That's probably not going to be a lot of these. Somebody will figure out what the best is, and then everybody would go to that, because people naturally just want to win. So, some people anyway. So I think this would have to be, you know, the kind of match that speed would be part, capacity could be a part. You know, you could do a lot of different things. You could do a lot of different things. But I would have no optics. And I would also have, you know, no enhancement, no bull barrels. You know, you're just waiting. The guy is going to, somebody's going to show up with their low power variable optic on top of their bull barreled 10/22. And frankly, those are the guys you want to keep out. Now, a guy who shows up with a regular barreled 10/22 and 30-shot magazine and iron sights, hey, that'd be perfectly welcome. But the guy with the big dollars who's, you know, basically, they look at the course of fire, and then they go about in their minds designing the best workaround rifle. You know, they look at the rules and figure the best workarounds. No, that's not what this would be about. So I would say something like that would be the best. The only other shooting sport I can think of is maybe some more, you know, like two-gun. I like that concept of two-gun. And maybe some of that done in more of a team environment. Safety becomes a real huge consideration. So that's always a lot harder. But I think team shooting is something that we should get back to. We used to do a lot of that with bullseye leagues and everything else. And I think that it kind of turns an individual sport, gives it more of a team flavor, which is always a better thing. So those would be my suggestions. Okay, last question of the day. And this is always this is always a juicy one. And I think we've actually talked about this before. You know what? We have had this question before. But I'll go ahead and give it another shot, maybe from a little different perspective. Are bolt-action battle rifles obsolete? Well, considering that they were obsolete 100 years ago in World War I, I say that's pretty good. I'd say yes is a pretty safe answer to that. You know, there's really nothing you can do to a bolt action that makes it shoot faster. And that's what it's all about these days. Are they accurate? Yes. Are they robust? Yes. To the fact that the Danish Sirius Patrol still uses them in northern Greenland. They use U.S. model 1917 rifles, 100-year-old rifles, because they're reliability in the frigid temperatures up there where they encounter polar bears and I guess that's the meanest creature they probably come across. But there's no mercy from a polar bear, so they have to have a rifle that works, and apparently that's what they still use. Up until very recently, and I think even now, the Canadian Rangers use the number 4 Lee Enfield. And I think that's just been replaced by another bolt action. I think it's a Seiko. I call it Seiko. It's actually Sako. But, you know, it's one of those. Something from Finland, you know, where people know about how cold weather rifles. So they've got one of those going on. So bolt action rifles are still around, depending on your purpose. But there's very few purposes where they are not obsolete. As far as being a battle rifle goes, you will still see them. However, I remember when Venezuela was acting like jerks like 2 years ago or something, and they were afraid of a U.S. invasion, and they were handing out Mauser rifles to the the third string partisan militia chicks. You know, you saw these women running around with Mauser rifles, strictly photo op. But it shows you that some countries still have a warehouse or two, or maybe even more, filled with the old bolt-action rifles. I would have thought we would have bought them all up by now. I mean, in the 90s, everybody who had them seemed to have dumped them on the market. Back in the heyday when, you know, the Lee Enfields were $60 a piece, Mosin Nagants were like $40 to $50, Russian capture Mausers were under $100. You know, it goes on and on and on. Swedish Mausers, you know, were under $100. You could really find some great bargains, great condition rifles as great bargains. And most of them didn't have matching numbers or any of that if they had numbers. But, you know, there was a great deal out there. I thought most countries sold them off. But every once in a while, you see these clips and they're current contemporary clips of people running around with bolt action rifles. So, you know, who knows, there may be another wave at some point of these things come in there when they finally divest. But yes, while they still work and they're as good as they ever were, the tactics and requirements of a rifle have changed so much that they no longer fit the performance envelope that's needed. So yes, they are. I know they have this question on, I've seen it on InRange TV, you know, and apparently people, it's one of those bait and trap questions of, yeah, I say they're obsolete, and then some guy in the comments will go, no, they're not, my Mosin Nagant will kill somebody at 1,000 yards. I mean, and they go back and forth with some of this nonsense. So, you know, it's really a bait and trap question. Of course they're obsolete. In World War One, they essentially determined that they were obsolete. And every country basically was putting some sort of effort after the war to find a semi-automatic replacement. And, you know, some countries were successful, some weren't. The United States and Soviet Union were pretty successful. Other countries really weren't. And then you've seen, and Forgotten Weapons actually has got a couple of them. I forget what they're called, but, you know, the semi-automatic conversions of the Lee Enfield that, you know, have the funny gas piston hanging on it, and then a big rod that goes back to the bolt and unlocks it. And, you know, all those things were found to be, you know, complete contraptions and not practical in any sense other than to demonstrate that there was some sort of applied technology that you could use to create something like that, but they were never going to convert the existing rifles in a practical way from manual operation to semi-automatic operation. It just wasn't going to happen. So, yeah, everybody saw that in World War One, and everybody knew they needed something else. But, you know, economics plays a big part of that. After the war, countries had more weapons than they could use, so they just kind of stuck with them, which is why the Second World War, in a large part, was fought with many of the same style weapons, and in some cases, the exact same weapons that they had in the First World War. You know, there just was a glut of these things, and replacing them cost money, and gambling on technology. That's where, you know, a lot of people criticize Springfield Armory over the M14 fiasco, they call it, where it took years to develop the M14, and then we found out we really had designed a rifle for 1945 and not 1965, which was when we needed it. But you can contrast that to Springfield Armory in the 20s and 30s, which developed some very, very innovative weapons, and the end product of all that was the M1 rifle. And the M1 rifle, you know, it definitely was the best battlefield rifle in World War II. You know, the STG-44 was the new way, but, you know, it only showed up in limited numbers at the end of the war. The Garand was there the whole time, and it basically was responsible for a lot of tactical success. It was a great tool to have. Absolutely. And that's why the weapon is so revered today. It's revered. And its battlefield performance is the reason why. So that's the case. Yes, they are obsolete. Yes, that is a bait and trap question. But I don't care if they're obsolete or not. I love them. I think they're beautiful things. And even the ones that are 100 years old or even older are just works of art. I mean, it's manufacturing art to see some of these bolt action rifles. Just the amount of machining and fitting and all of that stuff. Really, really wonderful to behold. You know, it's something from a bygone era, that's for sure. The woodworking, the metalworking. All those things are very, very impressive if you really like quality. The one thing you can talk about, I can't think of anything other than extreme late war examples, but every rifle I've ever seen has, you know, they exhibit a quality that you look at and it's very, very impressive. So anyway, that's this edition of Old School Guns. As always, go ahead and hit the like button, hit the subscribe button, and whatever button you can find. And I know if you hit the subscribe button, you'll get a notification as to when the next episode is posted. Until then, this is Old School Guns, out.